Trigger warning, this episode contains mentions of sexual assault and violence. Hi everybody, my name is Nishtha.
And I am Pragya.
And we're your hosts for the podcast Intersectional Feminism, Desi Style, brought to you by Feminism in India. So as all of the budding feminists out there who are listening to us know, patriarchy is something that is all pervasive in our life. It's diktats, it's rules, it's morals. They kind of make their way into everything that we end up doing, and that can get really frustrating. But frustrating is one thing. What happens when diktats of patriarchy actually tend to pervade the very institutions that are supposed to guarantee us justice? That becomes something that's a difficult problem, and that's something that's difficult to deal with. And that's exactly what we're going to be talking about today. Today's episode, we're here to understand what happens when moral judgments and diktats of patriarchy end up creeping into our courts.
You know, despite the fact that I have been fortunate enough to receive higher education, I am still unaware of my rights, and even the ones that I'm aware of, I still struggle to implement them in my everyday. I mean, of course, it's needless to say, like you mentioned, Nishtha, that our legal systems are Brahminical and patriarchal and essentially male-dominated. It lacks diversity and sensitivity. So there is a dire need to engage with our laws and our legal systems through a feminist perspective. And that is exactly what we are going to do today.
So Pragya, like you mentioned, we have our higher education, but higher education and legal awareness are two completely different things. And so instead of other episodes where Pragya and I go on and on, we actually have a very interesting guest with us today who's going to speak about this with us a little bit more. We have Aishwarya Subbaiah, who is an advocate with 4 years of litigation experience in the trial and high court and has litigated in Kerala, Maharashtra and Andhra Pradesh. She's also worked as a legal consultant and research associate for organizations advising them on CEDAW and gender-based violence. Thank you so much for being here with us today, Aishwarya. We're so excited to have you on today's episode.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
I don't know how many of you are aware, by the way, but recently during the pandemic, a committee was formed by the Ministry of Home Affairs to look into reforms pertaining to the criminal law system. The big issue here was that this committee was all male. And despite preaching inclusivity and having so many legal representatives from marginalized gender groups, caste and ethnic groups, the committee only had upper caste male legal academicians. This and many such other aspects show that our legal systems are still so male dominated. And what it does is that when sensitive issues pertaining to women and trans women, queer people, trans people, Muslims, Dalits, Adivasis are discussed in the courtroom, history has been witness to multiple accounts of moral policing through virtues of Brahminical and patriarchal honor. So, Aishwarya, how do you navigate between social activism and your career in the legal world, given that institutions of law and its discourses have in general been so patriarchal and male-dominated?
So, Pragya, the issue is that, as with any profession, of course, all professions are influenced by the people and their prejudices and their biases. So no profession can be completely removed from personal prejudices and personal biases. Everything gets brought out into work as well. But the problem with this and judiciary in particular, or the larger criminal system, is that people are bringing these prejudices into a space of conflict, into a space where inherently there are moral decisions being made, decisions of right and wrong. And that is extremely problematic. So as a personal, on a personal front, as an advocate, I also have to navigate through these prejudices that I myself might carry onto where I do my job and how I do it and who I work with and how I interact with the people that I work with. The fact that I choose to do a certain kind of work, or I choose to do what you would, as you said, a certain kind of activism, lends that I be more conscious of the kind of cases that I take on, the kind of spaces that I occupy, and that I be respectful of the kind of people that I work with. But this is necessarily not the case in the larger criminal system as it exists in India. By saying the criminal system or the larger criminal justice system, it includes every single aspect of it. So it starts from the police, the state, and the various actors of the state who enforce and implement these laws and carry them up to the judiciary, who are, of course, a decider of these laws. Okay, so when we're talking about this larger criminal justice system, what one has to understand is that, of course, not everyone is well-versed in these matters. Not everybody is an activist judge or an activist lawyer. And there are a vast majority of people who view this as a profession and purely as a profession and have no interest whatsoever in whether this criminal justice system is quote unquote just. A lot of people who are involved in the system do not care about the justness of it, or are not in a position to care about the justness of it. As I said, they do view it as a profession. They see it as a way to support themselves or as a means of livelihood, which is not something that we can find fault with in and of itself. But on a larger question, when you're looking at it from a larger viewpoint, it is extremely problematic that there are people who are in the justice system who do not care about justice. It is difficult as a woman to work within these structures, because the very nature of the justice system in India is not women friendly, and that is a fact, and that is something that almost every advocate that I've worked with has reiterated in some way or the other. Problem is that this profession, when it comes to dealing with women advocates, becomes personal. So as a part of my profession, when I enter these halls, or when I enter high courts or trial courts, what I have seen and what I have faced is a lot of personal remarks that are made towards me, which are not made towards my male colleagues. On a personal example, so when I was entered a high court, and I will not name which one, one of the other advocates, the first thing that she said to me was that I had to tie up my hair. I had very short hair at that time. It was above my shoulder. But still, the point was that I should not be addressing a high court with my hair let down. And it made no sense to me, because I failed to see what the length of my hair or what my hairstyle has got anything to do with my ability to make a case or to present my facts or to make an argument. However, all of these superficial preconceived notions come into play here. And I am asked to tie my hair up. I am asked to not wear big earrings. I am asked to maintain a certain decorum and a certain sense of style, and how I wear it, everything matters. Now, this is much more an issue when it comes to women lawyers than when it comes to their male counterparts. Of course, in courts, we do have a uniform. We do wear our blacks and whites. We wear our courts, blazers. We have our gowns on. So there is a certain amount of uniformity. But women are still held to a much higher standard in something as basic as, you know, our appearance. So the backlash or the issues that women face start before we even get to present our arguments. These are issues that are spoken about amongst women advocates. I've had a lot of my colleagues come and tell me this, and they've said that they faced similar outbursts from not just fellow lawyers, fellow advocates, but also from judges who've made comments on how they're not properly attired, for example. But this is unfortunately not spoken about, because in the larger picture, people would say, why are you cribbing about this? You're expected to dress in a way, or you're expected to be properly attired, and how is that wrong? The funny thing is, when you think about it, it's not wrong, but why are you holding certain people more accountable or to higher stringent standards, or to standards that are not relevant to the profession? And now, Pragya, as to your question as to how I handle my activism and navigate this field, I think this was just an example that I wanted to say about how difficult it is on a general, like on a very subtle level as well. But when you take up these cases of quote unquote activism and you enter the court, the issue is that many times you get labeled as an activist lawyer. And I think that in itself is problematic, because these are issues that at the base of it is something that everybody should be concerned about. And however, this label that they tag on you as an activism or that, oh, she always does PILs or she always does writ petitions or these are the kind of cases that she handles, there is a prejudice that forms in the minds of judges as well as advocates, other advocates, your colleagues or everything. Not only am I navigating my profession, my aptitude as a lawyer, my knowledge of the law, my case law, everything, all of that that I have inside my head and my ability to present what I have to say in front of a judge, but I also have to navigate and fight against these bias, this inherent bias, this prejudice, and this general disdain that people seem to have towards this kind of work that's done. And bear in mind that this is very necessary work, that this is the kind of work that needs to be done. These are often cases that we are fighting for, where we are fighting for gender rights, or we are fighting for housing rights, or we are fighting for reproductive rights, LGBTQ rights. But there is a certain disdain for people who do this on a day-to-day basis. I don't know about the both of you, but maybe this is something that you guys also happen to come across in your respective professions. Even the word feminism has such negative attributes. And that, of course, carries on to a legal system as well.
No, Aishwarya, what you're saying is so extremely relatable. I think Pragya and I will both relate that the minute, honestly, I tell people that I work for an organization called Feminism in India, everybody gives me what I can only describe is as the look, which is sort of that, oh, you know, we've already categorized you as the kind of person you are, the kind of work that you do, the kind of arguments that you'll have, things that we can say in front of you and things that we can't say in front of you. And this is sort of something that goes beyond just our professional circles, but also goes into families and friends and things like that. The minute you say that, you know, like exactly what you said, feminism itself has just become such a consensus term. But anyway, more on my personal rant later. You actually gave us a great example of how sexism kind of manifests itself in courtrooms. But can you elaborate for us a little bit on what kind of moral policing you actually witnessed in your educational institutions when you were actually studying law?
So I went to a 3-year law course. I didn't go through the national law school system of 5 years. I did my undergrad and then I did my law. In a 5-year law school, you do these general subjects like political science and history and sociology and all of that. But in a 3-year law school, it's just law. So all you do is 30 semesters of just pure law and that's it. So here, the issue is, I don't know if I would call it moral policing as much as I would say a general idea of how education is. So we had a subject called gender justice. So the law school that I went to churns out hundreds of lawyers every single year. It's a big institution, a lot of people enroll in it, and it just produces a lot of lawyers, some really great ones, but yeah. So, and even though there is a subject called gender justice, amongst these hundreds of people who were my classmates, the number of people who turned up to this, who opted, and this was an optional subject, it was not a mandatory subject, which in and of itself is something that we can talk about. But the number of people who opted for this in my batch was about 30 odd students. But if you compare that to, say, company law or intellectual property rights or one of the other subjects that people had to opt for, where hundreds of people were enrolled for this, I think that would show, would be able to kind of, is an example of how the importance that people give to, say, something like gender justice. The fact that it's not mandatory, or the fact that it's not a part of the curriculum, that there is something called women's rights, or something called gender justice, is problematic.
I mean, definitely, Aishwarya, I completely relate to what you just said. Beyond our coursework and classrooms and courtrooms, I think our listeners, as well as I, would like to know that whether there were any other attempts from your educational institutions or even in your legal systems to equip aspiring as well as practicing lawyers with gender sensitivity, especially after the sexual harassment case that came up against one of the biggest judges that we have in India today. So was there a shakeup? Did people demand gender sensitization programs in courtrooms and or even within your classroom?
So I had already graduated from law school by the time all of the Me Too movement had actually started and kind of gained momentum, and I was a practicing lawyer at that time. But the sad thing is, at least amongst my peers and my colleagues, it did not have much of an impact in the right way. Of course, it was a sensational thing to talk about. It was something that was spoken about and debated, but nobody spoke about gender sensitivity or, you know, sensitizing young lawyers about the need for gender justice or about the need for women's laws. It just didn't translate into that. So, and I think that's where there's a big divide, because these issues are spoken about and they're talked about in certain circles or among certain people, especially because they're high profile cases. But they don't make the transition from talking about these cases or discussing them into actually implementing a program or a course or any kind of a panel to kind of sensitize young lawyers or young law students. And that transition somehow never happens. There is, of course, a difference. I can't say that there has been no change at all since these few landmark cases in recent times. The people who were practicing this kind of the kind of law that, you know, deals with women's issues have continued to do so. And those who have worked in other avenues of law continue to do so. There is not much of a crossover there, and I think that's necessary.
If you had to suggest some ways to equip lawyers with gender sensitivity, where do you think we should start?
Definitely in law school. There are courses like gender justice, women's rights, LGBTQ rights. They should be made mandatory. I hope that there are law schools across the country where it is so. Sociology, of course, is another. And law, I think people forget, is so interdisciplinary in and of itself. You can't remove law from society and how society functions. And therefore, having inputs from sociology or political science or just general history, even as to how how society works has impacted how laws formed. So colonialism, for example, has a huge impact on law. A lot of our legal, our core canon legal acts were made during the British colonial times, and we still carry them forward. We still have laws that are remnants of colonialism. So we can't remove history from how law works. We can't remove politics from how law works. Certain acts, certain laws were formulated as for political mileage. Similarly, it's the same with sociology. How society exists, how society functions, has a huge impact on how law works. So interdisciplinary teaching of law, where these kind of subjects are made mandatory to law students, I think would make a big impact. Secondly, and I think this is also an issue, is that people can become judges at the lower courts, so the munsif and the magistrate level, at a very young age. They don't need to have any legal experience to do so. Right out of law school, you can write your judiciary exam and you can become a judge if you qualify that exam. Of course, it's a three-step process, but still, that's it. There is no legal experience. There's no litigation requirement. There's no work experience required to become a judge. And to me, that is also an issue. So when you're looking at a country like UK, for example, the median age for judges or something is around in the late 50s or early 60s. But in India, you have the age, I think the median starting age is around late 20s or early 30s. So you see this big gap, this big divide in experience. And just putting people into these positions of authority or these decision-making positions and asking them to decide on matters when they have not litigated, they have not worked in that environment, I think also leads to a certain bit of chaos. A certain amount of training, a certain amount of experience should be made mandatory to everybody who maybe wants to qualify as a judge. And I think that would really help them.
So, Aishwarya, you know, like how you mentioned that there is a certain age gap when it comes to people being appointed judges, and because there is definitely a lack of gender sensitivity currently in the curriculum of lawyers, it's not really that hard to kind of piece together that sometimes courtrooms can be biased. And like you'd really began this episode with talking about, that a certain level of bias is something that no profession is sort of away from or can keep away from. But what are the repercussions of these biases when they actually play out in the courtroom? And also, to follow up on that question, do you think that these repercussions vary for people from different backgrounds?
Yeah, Anisha, absolutely. So there are, if you look at the Supreme Court of India, the strength of the Supreme Court is actually 34. There are 34 justices in the Supreme Court. But presently, there are only two women sitting justices, Justice Indira Malhotra and Justice Indira Banerjee. And in the history of the Supreme Court, there have only been 8 female justices, which I think is, of course, extremely problematic. The fact that the Supreme Court has existed, the highest court of the land, which has existed since, I think it was established in the 1930s, 1937 or something. But in the history of the Supreme Court, there have only been 8 women justices. Presently in India, there are also only around 78 high court justices all across the country. And I think there are 6 high courts in which there are no women judges. And that is a huge problem, because you have men in these decision-making places, in these positions of power, where debating on issues that pertain to women, that pertain to minorities, sexual minorities, religious minorities, and there is not enough representation. I mean, leave alone equal representation, which I think is a far cry. There are high courts and the Supreme Court where there is no representation. We don't have a Dalit justice of the Supreme Court. There are high courts which do not have any women judges. So in answer to the second part of your question as to whether there are bias, whether courtrooms are biased and what are the repercussions of it, and whether these repercussions vary for people from different backgrounds, absolutely. This has been widely studied and has been widely written about, that people from Dalit backgrounds or people from religious minorities have faced stricter sentencing, that sentencing that has been meted out to them are far harsher than people from other backgrounds. So upper caste, upper class people, or even people who are from the majority religion definitely get a pass. It has also been written about that people who are from these minorities, in fact, are more likely to be given the capital punishment for the same crime than people who don't belong to these minorities, or religious minorities or Dalits. And that's a very in-your-face kind of distinction that is being made. And the way India exists on the whole, like especially if you belong to North Indian states, a lot of people's castes, for example, can be figured out from their surname. So it's not very difficult to see how these prejudices can act out in such, in that situation, because it's not possible for an accused to hide their caste in certain instances. And therefore, it's easier for certain prejudices to play out in that situation. And because you do not have representation in these positions of power, this is something that perpetuates. Now, the issue with the legal, in the beginning, I spoke about how every profession has biases and prejudices that the people in that profession bring to it. Now, the problem with the legal system is that the repercussions are not often limited to one person or to one set of people. It goes on for many years. So when you have a Supreme Court or a High Court give out a judgment or an order, the precedent that it sets impacts many cases after it. So you have years and years of cases and case law being decided on that one precedent until and unless that precedent is overruled. And that may never happen. It's entirely possible that a judgment, a problematic judgment, may hold strong for generations. So that's why bias and prejudice within the legal system has overarching repercussions that go above and beyond a certain place or a certain time period. I think, Pragya, when you, in the beginning, you were talking about the the reforms committee that is being set up and how it has only male members in it. I think that's kind of like, again, like I said, it's a microcosm of what the larger picture is, that you have all of these committees, you have all of these institutions, you have institutions at various levels, you have trial courts and high courts and the Supreme Court, where there is not adequate representation from women, from minorities, from sexual minorities, from religious minorities, and from Dalits. So it leads to a very unipolar, one way of looking at things, one kind of judgment, which is proving to be quite harmful.
Aishwarya, I also remember you mentioned before that the legal system is also very intricately tied to the police, especially when you talk about, say, violence against women. And we have heard so many cases of custodial injustice, say rape, violence, even just general disregard, especially for women and for people from marginalized communities, for queer and trans people. These things are not news. How can then women and marginalized people receive justice? And are there any special systems or lawyers or teams appointed when such cases demand sensitivity?
So Pragya, there are certain provisions in place so which protect women and children, you know, when they're giving testimony or when they're giving the statement before a magistrate. And this is, of course, again, it's a pretty recent development. There is the POCSO Act, which is the Protection of Children from Sexual Offences Act, which the name kind of explains itself. And women, especially when they have to give testimonies of sexual assault, they are entitled to have support when they are giving this testimony. So under Section 164.5A of the CRPC, the Criminal Procedure Code in India, women victims of sexual assault can have with them an educator or an interpreter or a translator to help them give their account in front of a judge. Now, what we see here is sometimes that this just is not followed. So there was a case recently in Bihar where a judge actually issued a contempt notice against a survivor of an attack because she insisted that her statement be read by some people that she trusted before she signed it. A contempt notice was issued against the survivor and she was put into jail. Now, see, I think that's kind of an example of how where the law is written and how the law actually performs and how there's a disparity between the two, where on one, women on paper, women are entitled to these kind of support systems and a lot of provisions. For example, sexual assault survivors are entitled to in-camera trials, they're entitled to privacy, their names must not be revealed. They have a whole host of laws that protect them. But when we actually see it in actuality and in practice, we see that there's a big divide between what's written and what actually happens. And I think this ties into what the previous question was, where we had discussed about how there just isn't enough representation amongst judges and amongst the judiciary, where proper implementation of laws just does not happen. Now, I'm not making the claim that, of course, if it was a woman judge, she would automatically be perfect, or that laws would be implemented, or that her judgments would be perfect. Or conversely, I'm not making the claim that just because it's a male judge, again, he would not. But what we see on the whole, or as the situation stands as of right now, is that we see a failure of the implementation of these laws, implementation of all of these protective measures of in order to, you know, stop the re-victimization of the victim, which is a huge deal. When you take a survivor of any a sexual assault or of gender-based violence, and you put that survivor through this entire lengthy process of going through courts and going through starting from the police station, going to the police station, filing an FIR, getting that file, getting that into the lawyer's hand, getting it in front of the court, and then the whole process in the court itself is traumatic. It's a painful experience. And we just don't see a support system as it should be. And so much of this process, even amongst the police force in India, which we know is kind of male dominated, you see a lot of male influence in this process, which kind of negates or trivializes the female experience. Or it makes it uncomfortable for women to be in those positions, and their comfort is not taken into priority. So in the whole process of giving out justice, what we see is that there's so much focus on bringing the accused to justice, quote unquote justice, that they fail to see the impact of it on the survivor or the victim. We have had numerous cases where the cases have been dismissed offhand because the complainant or the survivor did not act as the judge expected her to act. So there have been cases that have been dismissed because the survivor did not resist, which is the Mathura rape case, very, very famous one. Again, the Supreme Court dismissed it, saying that the survivor was sexually promiscuous or habituated, quote unquote, habituated to sex, and therefore could not have been raped, or that she did not resist enough and therefore could not have been raped, which is problematic. Very recently, in this case called Mahmood Farooqi versus Government of Delhi, again, the judge said that a feeble no is not equal to a no. And that, again, does not make sense. I mean, I don't understand why there are parameters to just saying no. What's a feeble no? What's a strong no? So all of these modes of how a person who has already gone through this traumatic experience of assault should behave is dictated by somebody else. There have been statements made like, this is not how Indian women behave, or this is not how our women behave. And they're putting up all these personalized ideas of patriarchy onto somebody else. They're projecting their internalized patriarchy onto somebody else. But then you expect them to behave in a certain way in order to get a favorable judgment. And it's a long line of very complicated procedure that is presently not friendly to the victim. And I think that's the most unfortunate part of it all, because you're re-victimizing the victim. The survivor goes through so much of trauma, and then they put through so much of trauma again in order to get what is justice. I don't know. I would like to say the disclaimer that this is a very personal opinion. It's not a general understanding of law. And it is what I would say is my measured opinion, is that it doesn't matter how much the punishment is, as much as there is a certainty of punishment. So if the laws that are set down in place, and we have some fantastic laws, if they were implemented properly, if the police or if the systems of justice worked properly and adequately and quickly, and that's very important, if it worked quickly, then how much of a punishment is not an issue, because the whole idea of justice should be reformative, and it should not be retributive. It shouldn't seek revenge as much as it should seek to also reform the people who have kind of committed these crimes, or at least attempt to reform those who have committed these crimes.
So what you just said, Aishwarya, makes me think about the fact that the legal system is still struggling with very basic problems of sensitivity and very basic problems of minoritization. What more can be done to encourage minorities to combat sexism and misogyny, not only, say, in the courtroom, but in the larger system of legal redressal?
So it's actually what you said is so important, because even during the course of this conversation, we kind of see that there is so much negativity that comes forward, and there's this kind of haplessness that kind of maybe comes forward when we hear these stories of how the legal system has failed in so many ways, or is not adequate in so many ways. But then I think as a part of it, we also need to understand that there have been positive examples, and there have been favorable judgments. It hasn't all been negative. Obviously, there has been a movement forward when it comes to these avenues, some steps in the right direction. Where when you're talking about other minorities and other gender minorities, we recently, especially in post 2000-2010, we've seen many judgments that have given rights to transgenders. We have NALSA versus Union of India that recognize the third gender as a gender, and we have Navtej Singh Johar Puttaswamy judgment, which of course talks about privacy and the right to privacy and so on and so forth. And at a state level in Tamil Nadu, the Madras High Court came out with a judgment called Nangai versus Superintendent of Police, where a person who was trans was able to identify as a woman and was able to enroll in the police forces, in the state police forces as a woman. So these are landmark judgments that have come out, and they are coming out, and there are a lot of people who have been fighting for this and who will continue to do so. So I think we really do also have to look at that we can't get bogged down by the negativity, that so much so that we forget the positive, because in order to, I think, be able to make a change or to continue arguing cases in this space, we also have to reinforce the fact that there are positive precedents, because only if we can see that, okay, there has been a positive outcome, so it kind of gives us hope in order to be able to maybe, you know, be able to get a positive outcome ourselves. If we want the legal system to be more compassionate or intersectional or understanding, to be more inclusive, I think would be the word that I would use, is I think it starts with education. I think it starts with a certain kind of, at the core of it, I don't think there's any other way out. I think we need to kind of be able to get to law students, get them to reinforce these certain ideas of what the Indian Constitution is built upon, the quote-unquote values that the Constitution of India stands for, the rights, the fundamental rights that are available to everybody. And how do we exercise these rights? If you ask a lay person, I mean, there's something in law that says that ignorance of law is not an excuse. So that's actually a tenet of law, that ignorance of law is not an excuse. But if you ask the lay person as to what their rights are or what the laws are, how aware are they actually of what they're entitled to or what is available to them? They really are not. And this applies to, you know, people living in cities, people who are educated and whatnot. So if you go deeper into villages or even to rural areas or peri-urban areas in India, you would realize that people are just unaware of all the legal entitlements that they have. And I think that's also an area that we need to discuss. So not only do we need to have these kind of sensitization programs that are aimed towards law students, we also need to make the country as a whole more legally aware of their rights. They are less likely to be swindled. They're less likely to be they're less likely to be taken advantage of if they know that they have a right to something. What I've come to see is that ignorance of these laws have these consequences that are kind of far-reaching. For example, you constantly hear stories of misuse of certain laws. Again, I would like to put misuse under quotes, so quote-unquote misuse of certain laws. But what we see that when people talk about the misuse of these laws, they always talk about laws which are women-centric or Dalit-centric. And there are so many articles and discussions and debates over quote-unquote misuse of these laws. So you have... So we hear a lot about the misuse of 498A, which is, of course, a prevention of cruelty towards a wife. And what we see is that the reality of the matter is a lot of these cases are not even reported. Cases of harassment against women, cases of sexual assault against women, cases of dowry harassment, marital rape are not even reported in Afghanistan. They're dangerously underreported. And even with those few cases which are reported, they don't go to court. And even with those few cases that do go to court, it's sometimes they come out in our favor, I mean, in the favor of the complainant, but sometimes they don't. And even with that minuscule amount of cases, what we hear more about are about the misuse of these laws rather than the use of these laws and how even the implementation or the use of these laws have failed. And then, so where does the question of misuse even come about? Similarly, you have the SCST Prevention of Atrocities Act. And again, there's the word misuse is thrown around a lot with respect to that act itself also. And when you hear so many cases of atrocities or of issues, I mean, of violence against members of the SCST community, and then we talk about how there is misuse, the point is, these are cases that are severely underreported. And I think NCRB, the National Crime Records Bureau, statistics state that about 2% of these cases end up in conviction or something. Like I said, there are some fantastic judges across the country. There are a lot of people that I've litigated in front of, that I've had the honor of appearing in front of, who have been absolutely fantastic. They've been compassionate people who have big believers of in the law and who follow process, due process, and who follow the law and who believe in natural justice. And I think we really need to kind of hold on to that at the end of it all and know that there are, in various parts of the criminal justice system, whether they be police, whether they be advocates, whether they be prosecutors, whether they be judges, that there are people who do believe in natural justice and who believe in the implementation and the process of law. And I think that is what we need to kind of leave ourselves with, because that kind of gives us the hope to carry this forward. So, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Aishwarya, not just for being here today, but also for giving us some really insightful thoughts and comments on the current Indian legal system. I think, yes, for me as a young woman who's trying to navigate her space in this country, sometimes when I look at cases, when I look at judgments, some of the statistics that you've shared with us today, things can seem a little daunting. One does tend to get disheartened. But I think with what you've ended on today is that we just need to keep having these conversations and make sure that we don't let any of this sort of go to waste, and keep faith that one day these conversations will lead to some really tangible change. And I think that's a great note to end this episode on. Thank you so much for taking out the time to be with us here today. And we're so excited that we had you on here today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was actually, I don't know if I want to use the word fun, but this was insightful, and it gave me something. It gave me an opportunity to talk about something that I'm quite passionate about. And it's something that I do. It's been fun talking with you. I would say that, but it's been great being on this. So thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much, Aishwarya. And adding to that, this is also a general message for all our feminists, all our law students who are listening to us, or even lawyers, that there is always a space for taking your activism to the court. There are ways that you can stand up for the minorities. There are ways to use your privilege so that people who do not have the same kind of power can receive justice and approach the legal system in a more effective way. And I think Aishwarya has also told us that there are ways to set very powerful and feminist precedents so that the legal system does not feel unapproachable to a layperson who do not understand the laws and the nitty-gritties.
And that brings us to the end of this episode. As always, we would love to hear your feedback, so do let us know what you thought of this episode and join us next Thursday as we take a look at how accessible public spaces in India are for persons with disability. Follow Feminism in India on all social media platforms. Thanks for listening in, and do tune in for the next episode.